From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
People who weren't abiding by the terms of their contracts with us were sought out and found. I think the use of Pinkertons to do that is inappropriate, and we've stopped doing it.
Today, a rare interview with Monsanto's CEO, Robert Shapiro, and a critic.
Monsanto has become a virtual retirement home for members of the Clinton administration.
The question of what goes on a food label is the subject of legislation, is the subject of FDA regulation. My sense of it is that process works reasonably well.
Monsanto scientists go out, work for the FDA, write up the regulations, and then go back to Monsanto.
And Democracy Now! Gets thrown out of a Waldorf Astoria ballroom, but not before asking NBC's Katie Couric a question.
I mean, here you are honoring Bob Shapiro and the others. Will you be doing any kind of coverage of the controversy around biotechnological food on the Today Show?
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Presidential hopeful Bill Bradley challenged Vice President Al Gore last night to press President Clinton to issue an executive order banning racial profiling. It was the sixth and final debate between the two Democratic presidential candidates before the first votes are cast in the Iowa caucuses 1 week from yesterday. Bradley seized the offensive at a debate sponsored by the Iowa Brown Black Presidential Forum, a group that promotes black and Latino issues, after Gore pledged to sign an executive order himself banning profiling, the practice of singling out African Americans for police questioning. Bradley said, "You know, Al, I know that you would issue an order to end racial profiling if you were president of the U.S., but we have a president now. You serve with him. I want you to walk down that hallway, walk into his office and say, sign this executive order today." Meanwhile, the fight over the Confederate flag flying at South Carolina's State House has shifted inside after a demonstration at which more than 50,000 people called for the banner's removal. Only the legislature can remove the flag raised over the State House in 1962 during the Civil War centennial. Many demonstrators from out of state honored a tourism boycott by the NAACP and slept on cots in church basements instead of checking into hotels. Some lawmakers have said they will discuss a compromise only after the NAACP backs off the boycott, but NAACP President Kwasiam Fume said the boycott will remain until the flag goes. While South Carolina is the only state still flying the Confederate flag from its capital, Georgia incorporated the symbol into its state flag in 1956. The Reverend Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Push Coalition now wants tourists to boycott Georgia until the emblem is removed. Activists are threatening to begin the boycott on January 30th, the day the Super Bowl will be held in Atlanta. Glaxo welcomes planned acquisition of rival drug maker SmithKline Beecham would do more than create the world's largest pharmaceutical company. The deal, announced yesterday and worth about $76 billion in stock, is a clear sign that the merger trend now reshaping other industries is accelerating in the drug business. Just last week, Pfizer emerged as the likely winner in a battle with American Home Products for U.S. drug maker Warner Lambert, while Monsanto is in the process of merging with Pharmacia and Upjohn. Industry analysts predict other blue-chip names, including Eli Lilly, Schering Plough, Novartis, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and even merger-averse Merck, won't be far behind. Despite opposition from human rights campaigners, the European Union yesterday lifted a four-month-old arms embargo imposed on Indonesia during the violence that followed East Timor's vote for independence. The ban was lifted despite objections from the human rights group Amnesty International. The arms embargo was introduced to pressure Jakarta into accepting international peacekeepers in East Timor, where pro-Indonesia militias rampaged after the country voted overwhelmingly for independence. The European Union banned all sales of arms, munitions, military equipment, and other goods, quote, which may be used for internal repression. It also suspended military cooperation. Cuban mental health specialists say Elian Gonzalez could suffer emotional problems from a stay in the United States. The psychiatrists and psychologists contend the boy has not had time to properly mourn the loss of his mother. In addition, they say constant attention, especially from the news media, has overstimulated the six-year-old. The experts say they reached their conclusions after studying hours of footage of the boy recorded by TV crews in the U.S. Elian has been staying with his Miami relatives since being rescued off the Florida coast in November. Spain is throwing the issue of Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet back into Britain's hands. Spanish officials have sent London a judge's request that Pinochet undergo another round of medical tests after initial tests determined the 84-year-old wasn't medically fit to stand trial. The letter comes just one day before Britain's deadline for opinions on whether Pinochet should be extradited to Spain. British officials say they considered cancelling the extradition, but have asked Spain, France, Belgium, and Switzerland for their thoughts on the matter. Four groups, including Amnesty, are calling for a second medical exam for Pinochet. Pinochet is accused of massive human rights abuses during his 17-year reign. And there's a hearing today in Los Angeles in the case of former Symbionese Liberation Army member Sarah Jane Olson. Olson, formerly known as Kathleen Salaya, is accused of placing bombs under police cars in the mid-1970s. She was a fugitive until her arrest in Minnesota last year. Olson's lawyers want her trial to be postponed. And a gay rights group has produced a television ad that goes after Republicans who would keep gays out of the armed forces. The ad responds to a campaign by the Republican National Committee spotlighting the controversy surrounding Vice President Gore's position on gays in the military. The 30-second spot says the GOP presidential candidates are so busy fighting about who should serve that they may have forgotten the values we actually fight for. The Human Rights Campaign ad airs this week in Iowa and New Hampshire. And this news from Toronto, local officials and environmental groups are protesting a Canadian government agency's decision to fly weapons-grade plutonium across 300 miles of southern Canada. In a surprise move Friday, 4.2 ounces of plutonium was transported by helicopter from Sault Ste. Marie on the U.S. border to Atomic Energy of Canada Limited's plant in Chalk River, Ontario. The shipment was part of the Parallax project, a joint American-Russian experiment to determine whether commercial nuclear reactors in Canada can use material from decommissioned Russian nuclear weapons as fuel.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's
Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Environmental Protection Agency has announced new regulations aimed at reducing the risks from corn genetically engineered to produce its own insecticide. The decision on Friday, anxiously awaited by farmers, environmentalists, and the biotech industry, was seen as the acknowledgement of rising concerns over the safety of biotech crops. The EPA is directing biotech seed companies to ask farmers to voluntarily protect monarch butterflies by planting non-genetically engineered corn around the edges of biotech fields. A recent Cornell University study found that the pollen of the biotech corn known as BT could kill butterflies. However, environmentalists say the measures are not strong enough because they only require the companies to voluntarily comply with the EPA's suggestions, and they say that these very same companies have spent the last few months belittling the risks associated with bioengineered corn pollen. The measures come on the heels of the battle in Seattle, where tens of thousands of activists took to the streets to protest the World Trade Organization's secret proceedings, an issue that united farmers and environmentalists around the world. On the streets of Seattle was their concern over genetically engineered crops. Well, last week, after getting back from Seattle, Democracy Now! Producer Maria Carrion and I headed over to the Waldorf Astoria, where the New York Academy of Medicine was holding an event honoring the role of genetics in the new millennium. It was hosted by Katie Couric, who is anchor of the Today Show on NBC. The event specifically honored Monsanto CEO Robert Shapiro, as well as Henry McKinnell, CEO of Pfizer, one of the largest drug companies in the country, and Francis Collins, director of the National Human Genome Institute. I got a chance to interview Monsanto CEO Robert Shapiro outside of a cocktail party. They said he had 4 minutes. Since you only have a few minutes, I'm going to get right to some tough questions, sure, which I know you have been dealing with. Number one, the UK cafeteria of Monsanto has banned genetically modified food. What is your response to that?
Yeah, it wasn't the UK cafeteria. It was the vendor that we used to supply the cafeteria. And in the UK, there has been real concern expressed in the media and reflected, I think, on large parts of the public about the issue of genetically modified food and the question of food safety. Those questions, I believe, and more importantly, the regulatory agencies and scientific bodies of the world who have studied the questions believe those questions have been adequately resolved with respect to the products that are already being marketed. But there is widespread concern on the question of the safety of food in the UK, and I think that this particular vendor was responding to that concern.
Though serious irony that the Monsanto cafeteria does not provide genetically modified food, though it, of course, Monsanto is a maker of it.
Well, I think it's kind of amusing in a sense, but I don't think it has substantive meaning. The fundamental question is, I guess there are two fundamental questions. One is the food safe? That's a question of scientific fact. It's not an opinion question. And that question has been looked at by regulatory agencies in the U.S. and in the U.K. and throughout Europe, and the answer has uniformly been yes. The second question is, are people concerned about it? And the answer to that, to varying degrees, is yes, they are. And in the U.K. in particular, I think that reflects a lack of confidence that the regulatory review process adequately protects consumers, and that probably has something to do with their experience with the mad cow phenomenon.
Monsanto has fought the labeling of foods. Why, if you support any kind of freedom of choice of consumers?
It's been widely said that we oppose the labeling of food, and that's simply untrue. It has never been the case. We have never taken a position on the issue of labeling of food, and the reason for that is very simple. The question of what ought to be labeled in foods is a societal question. It is a question that ought to be resolved through an appropriate social and political process. In the United States, the FDA has taken the position, not Monsanto, that the origin of food oughtn't be the subject of labeling. Rather, the nutritional content of food ought to be labeled. That's an FDA position, not a Monsanto position. And my own view, for whatever it's worth, is that consumers have a right to know anything consumers want to know. They're the consumers. It's their families who are eating the food, and it's their money that's buying the food. If consumers want this sort of information, they ought to express that wish through appropriate political and regulatory channels, and let society decide how it wants to deal with the issue. I don't have a position on it one way or the other than to support consumer choice.
But Monsanto has fought companies putting labels on their food that say, for example, bovine growth hormone free.
Yeah, that's a different question. In that case, the FDA came out with guidelines for how that labeling ought to work. And the FDA had found that milk was produced with the aid of what we call BST, what you've called bovine growth hormone, that milk produced that way is identical to and indistinguishable from milk that's produced without the use of that supplement. The FDA therefore said that any labeling that purported to distinguish between one kind of milk and the other had to also point out that the FDA had found that there was no difference between the kinds of milk. We have gone to court to enforce that FDA guideline.
But the FDA didn't find that it is necessarily safe, genetically modified food. What they say is that it's equivalent. What about people who have religious concerns, for example, with GMO foods?
You have two different subjects mixed up in that. With respect to bovine hormone, they did specifically find it was safe. It went through a full regulatory review, and the finding was it is safe. With respect to genetically modified foods, which is a different subject, the FDA test is whether or not the food being produced through the use of biotechnology is substantially equivalent to the food that is being consumed today without the use of biotechnology. And that's based on their view that isn't tantamount to a finding of the safety of the food. Oh, you wanted to talk about the religious issue? Yeah. Obviously, anybody who markets food has to be concerned about the preferences of consumers, whether they're based on religion or taste or any other factor that leads consumers to come to one conclusion rather than another. Certainly, anybody who is choosing to market food that violated the fundamental religious beliefs of any community would, first of all, have to deal with an economic consequence to that, and secondly, would have an obligation, in my view, to allow that community to have meaningful choice.
Three last quick questions. One is, do you think there should be limits on life patents, on patenting of life?
I think it's a tricky question, and there's a balancing act that needs to be required, which is generally true in intellectual property. On the one hand, we do want a domain of freedom where people can freely use the developments of science for whatever purposes without them being restricted through patent law. On the other hand, patents are, in my view, a necessary evil in the sense that the granting of patents does stimulate people to spend a lot of money on research in order to try to invent things that ultimately will prove beneficial. The patent system is designed to strike a balance between those two public needs, and it does it by providing a patent for a limited period of time. My own sense is that on the whole that's an appropriate balance, but the issue of what is patentable, what constitutes an invention, and what society's view of intellectual endeavor ought to be, is, I think, it can't be answered by slogans that one thing is or isn't patentable. It's an important subject because we do want people to spend a lot of money trying to develop new drugs and more nutritious foods. And patents are one way of providing an incentive for people to do that.
Is Monsanto pledging never to use the Terminator seed?
Yes, we've already said that.
Never anywhere.
That's what we said.
Let me
be very direct about it. It's not simply the technology that some have called Terminator, which incidentally was never our technology. It never has been and never will be our technology. But what we've said broadly is that we will not use technology that renders seeds sterile. Not because there are, in my view, valid either scientific or economic objections to it, but simply because the very concept runs up against some very strong instincts and beliefs about the purpose of agriculture and the vital nature of seed, so that we are not going to use technologies that render seed sterile.
Last two questions. What did you think of the battle in Seattle, of the battle around the World Trade Organization, and particularly companies like Monsanto?
I wasn't there, so I don't have a firsthand reaction to it. I have read some very moving firsthand reactions from all sides of this. I recently read a piece that Paul Hawken wrote on the subject, and it was clear that Paul was deeply moved both by the courage of some of the demonstrators and also by the insensitivity, in his view, of the way in which some protest was dealt with by the authorities. My own view on it was that it was one of those moments that make very clear the opposition between two ways of thinking about the world, and that the issue for our next decade, at least, if not the next century or millennium, is going to be, how do you balance the economic efficiencies that come from a reasonably free market system on a globalized basis, on the one hand, and the aspirations of people not to be controlled by abstract and distant profit-making institutions? And that's a balance that society is going to have to bring some wisdom to. I think either pole of it is likely to lead to bad consequences. But working out the balance, I think, is a task that's going to engage us for quite a while.
You talked about the authorities and what they did in Seattle. I wanted to go to the issue that has caused a lot of controversy in farming communities around this country. This is the last question. Of Monsanto hiring Pinkerton detectives on farmers.
I think that was a foolish thing, and I thought a bad decision that was made for good purposes. The issue is this. We've been asking farmers to pay a fee for the use of the technology that we build into seeds. Most of the farm community has accepted that. No one is eager to pay fees, but have accepted that that's the price of getting better quality and new traits. What the farm community has been very emphatic on is that they don't want to have some farmers paying and other farmers cheating by retaining seed and not paying for its use. So there was an effort, and I think it was a good faith effort, to try to make sure that people who weren't abiding by the terms of their contracts with us were sought out and found. I think the use of Pinkertons to do that is inappropriate, and we've stopped doing it.
What do you think has been Monsanto's biggest mistake?
I think it's been a naive belief that the issue of biotechnology is fundamentally a scientific issue, rather than an issue that has to do with people's values, beliefs, and in particular their views of the roles of corporations in making social, technological, and economic change occur. My sense of Seattle is that that is a fundamental issue of our age, and it's one where the balance, in many people's view, has swung too far in the side of corporate power and unrestricted markets. And there have been ages like that in the past, and there's going to have to be a new balance struck.
So are you saying in this country you will not oppose labeling of genetically modified food?
We've never opposed labeling of modified food anywhere, nor have we favored it. I want to be very clear about this. We do not regard this as a decision for companies to be making. We regard this as a decision for society as a whole to be making. Now, many institutions have taken the view that the label on foods, and I hope you'll include this full answer and not just pull a line or two of it out, that the labeling of foods is a more complicated issue than simply a slogan about people's right to know. The question of what goes on a food label is the subject of legislation. It's the subject of FDA regulation. It's been the subject of a lot of thought and analysis. And my sense of it is that process works reasonably well, and I think the FDA is looking at that question today and will come to appropriate conclusions.
Doesn't Monsanto lobby on it?
Monsanto does not lobby on this subject. If anyone asks me my personal view about it, I think I've already said it, which is I believe consumers have a right to know anything they want to know. I think the question of whether the food label is the best place to provide that information is a question that companies like Monsanto or other companies ought not have a firm position on. Those are questions that ought to be resolved through a regulatory process.
Thank you. Bob Shapiro, CEO of Monsanto.
Thank you.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with a critic of genetically engineered food and the role of the corporation in deciding what we eat and what is grown around the world in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. We're now joined by Martin Teitel. He is the co-author of a new book called Genetically Engineered Food, Changing the Nature of Nature, What You Need to Know to Protect Yourself, Your Family, and Our Planet. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Martin Teitel.
Hi, Amy. It's nice to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us. As you could hear, I had this opportunity last week to go to the Waldorf Astoria, where Robert Shapiro, the CEO of Monsanto, was being honored by the New York Academy of Medicine, which prides itself on serving the urban poor. They were honoring the CEO of Pfizer as well as the CEO of Monsanto. So you've just listened to the interview. What's your response?
He started out talking about cafeteria, and it is an embarrassment that the Monsanto cafeteria in the UK doesn't serve genetically engineered food. And he said, well, the regulatory agencies of the world have resolved this question. No, that's not true. This question hasn't been resolved at all. There has been a whole series of mixed rulings from regulatory agencies all around the world. After all, most industrialized countries require labeling. Some states and countries have banned genetically engineered food. What he says is simply a wonderfully inaccurate generalization. He goes on to say the fundamental question is it safe? And, you know, the case that Shapiro is trying to make is that people are worried, even though these wonderful, wise people in governments have spoken. He's right. One of the fundamental questions, I don't think it's the only one, is this stuff safe? Well, there are no long-term studies at all, none, zero, regarding the safety of genetically engineered food, and yet it pervades about 60% of the processed food in the United States. We're all eating it. We're all feeding it to our kids. There are no long-term safety studies. The number of non-industry-funded, peer-reviewed, reasonably objective studies on safety of this food are way, way, way too small. So he's right. That's a good question. Is it safe? And what I would say is it just hasn't been demonstrated.
So what are these corporations saying, or when is Robert Shapiro saying when he says it's been proven that this food is safe? What studies is he talking about?
He says again and again and again in that piece that you just aired, Amy, that the FDA has found that this genetically engineered food is okay. What he doesn't say is that the FDA has never tested the food. The corporations who make it have tested it, sent the results to the FDA, sometimes only summaries of the results, and the FDA has accepted those summaries. The FDA is a little bit, in my view, delinquent. If you don't mind, let me just read you a little quote from a recent clip from the Toronto Globe and Mail, which says that Monsanto has become a virtual retirement home for members of the Clinton administration. And it goes on to say, to describe the revolving door between Monsanto's board and the administrative and regulatory bodies in our government. Monsanto scientists go out, work for the FDA, write up the regulations, and then go back to Monsanto. This has been well documented, particularly with bovine growth hormone, which is the conversation you had about milk.
Explain exactly what you mean by this revolving door.
Well, as the most famous example is a fellow named Michael Taylor worked for Monsanto, and he prepared a memo for the company about whether it would be constitutional for states to erect labeling laws concerning bovine growth hormone and dairy products. He was the guy who helped Monsanto figure out if the corporation could sue states who were trying to label milk as being bovine growth hormone free. Coincidentally, this same Michael Taylor ended up working for the FDA at the time that Monsanto's bovine growth hormone product was undergoing FDA approval. Taylor then developed, this is the former Monsanto employee, developed the Monsanto BGH labeling policy that Shapiro just referred to when you were talking with him. And this fact, Shapiro says that these are equivalent, was determined by Taylor. When Taylor was done doing that, he left the FDA. And where do you think he went to work? Back at Monsanto. So Shapiro saying that it's the FDA that has determined the labeling requirements for bovine growth hormone is true. It was his former and then present employee who did so. He also said that it was only fair from his point of view that this be done because, after all, the FDA had determined that the, I think he said that there was no difference between bovine growth hormone in milk and milk without bovine growth hormone. First of all, that's a very controversial statement. There's a fairly good amount of evidence that says that there is a difference. Second of all, can you think of any other label like that? If it says fat-free, if it says contains no MSG, if it says dolphin safe, if it says kosher, if it says organic, is there another statement that says, well, this is just somebody's belief, it's not really true? It's a very special, odd, and really unsupported labeling requirement that happens to have been written by a Monsanto person.
We're talking to Marty Teitel, who is co-author of Genetically Engineered Food, Changing the Nature of Nature. What about the Terminator seed and its implications? Was this a total victory of people who were suspicious of genetically modified food? What was it, and are you satisfied that Monsanto will never develop this technology or use it?
I'm actually pretty satisfied on this one. The Terminator technology is a technology that causes plants essentially to kill their own seeds. Shapiro gave a pretty good account of the fact that people around the world have been outraged by this. He's also technically accurate when he says that it was never his technology. Here's what happened. This technology was developed actually mostly by the U.S. government along with a company called Delta and Pine Land. This company Monsanto tried to buy for many, many years and recently gave up. The patent was owned by that company that wanted to be a Monsanto subsidiary. He's correct when he says that they never owned the technology because they technically never owned the company that owned the patent. But, Amy, I want to point out that there are 29 Terminator patents out there. A dozen of them are owned by Novartis, another big biotech company. Two of them are owned by United States publicly financed universities. So this is a technology that we have every reason in the world to be concerned about. In this case, probably we should look at Novartis as the company to be worried about rather than Monsanto.
The issue of the Pinkertons.
Well, I just love it that he says that we at Monsanto asked farmers to pay. Amy, that's like the IRS asking you to pay. They didn't ask farmers to pay. They handed them a contract and said, if you want to do business, if you want to grow this kind of crop, sign here. And that contract required them to do many things. For example, to buy Monsanto's products when they bought Monsanto's seeds. It also required them to permit Monsanto's Pinkertons onto their land, and he's quite right that it was a public relations disaster that backfired in many ways, including that the Pinkertons went after people who really hadn't planted Monsanto's seeds but had had Monsanto's genes attached to pollen drift over from neighboring fields. And it was the Pinkertons who helped those of us who are critics of this technology establish that genes really can drift with pollen.
I mean, this is quite something. They went onto people's property, tested the crops, said that they were Monsanto crops. The farmers would say, but we didn't use the Monsanto seed, and they didn't take into consideration wind and drift?
Nope. Nope. This is a company that frequently gets called arrogant, and it seems to me that it is arrogant to assume that they have the kinds of rights of surveillance and access that they assumed. And that they would hire the Pinkertons to do these kinds of things, especially with farmers, small business people who value their land as the source of everything they have. It was foolish, and I guess you have to give Shapiro a little credit that he copped to that.
He said that we've never opposed labeling, or rather, he said we haven't favored it either, and that it's up to the governments, and that Monsanto doesn't lobby on the issue.
Yeah, sure. Look, what Monsanto does is several things on this. You know, that they don't always do foolish things like the Pinkertons. Monsanto is corporately pretty silent on the question of labeling, especially recently. Instead, what they do is two things. They use surrogates. They have people who they fund outside the company, who they get to take this position. I get to debate them on the radio all the time. Second of all, I talked earlier about the revolving door with the FDA, and they just rely on their folks inside the FDA and inside various government agencies to do that work. This is a company that makes huge contributions to both parties, and they expect a good return on their investment. I think labeling is one of those places.
Do you think Monsanto was shaken by Seattle? He talked about it being a clash in beliefs, two ways of thinking. And at the New York Academy of Medicine, the actual program, the overall feeling as the CEO spoke was basically categorizing people as those that are pro-science and those that are anti-science.
Yeah, well, there's two questions here. One is about the WTO. He said he wasn't in Seattle. I was in Seattle, and I was very glad to hear that he had read the Paul Hawken account because I think it's the best that's been written. It's really very good, and maybe Shapiro learned something. It's really grotesquely disingenuous when Shapiro then goes on about a reasonably free market. In another section, he talks about limits on patents. One of the main or significant functions of the WTO is to be Monsanto's World Cup to protect and enforce its patents through the TRIPS agreement, the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Agreement, that forces countries around the world to adopt a uniform system of ownership just so companies like Monsanto can enforce their ownership over living things all around the world. The WTO is crucial to the biotech and especially the biotech food strategy. The fact that Shapiro kind of dismisses it lightly says that maybe he hasn't thought it through yet, or maybe he needs to read Paul Hawkins' memo one more time.
And where did Paul Hawkins' memo appear?
It's been floating around the Internet. I guess that's the best thing I can say is people keep sending it to me, and it has one of those documents that has taken on a life of its own, at least in that venue.
Marty, how well protected or insulated is Robert Shapiro from the press? How often does he get asked critical questions?
I've never heard anyone ask him the questions that you asked him, Amy. Usually Monsanto sends out specially trained spokespeople. They never let their scientists out in public, and I've not heard Shapiro questioned freely the way you questioned him.
Is he in the major media? I mean, does he get interviewed and they just don't ask him those questions, or is he so well protected, very well insulated, that he never comes out into the public except for one of these benefits and then assumes the person who's asking a question would be supportive and grateful?
I read quotes from Shapiro most often in the Wall Street Journal, The Economist, and The New York Times. And then there's their quotes.
Well, before we get to what's coming up and what people can do, I wanted to play for you just a quick comment from Katie Couric, the NBC Today Show anchor, who is actually honoring Robert Shapiro, CEO of Monsanto, at the New York Academy of Medicine event. And just before she went out onto the stage, I had a chance to, well, briefly talk to her. And this is what she had to say.
Can I ask you on this issue of biotechnology? We just interviewed Bob Shapiro of Monsanto. Clearly a very controversial issue, the issue of biotechnology and genetically modified foods. One of the questions we asked him is, as an ironic, in the cafeteria of Monsanto in UK, they have banned genetically modified food, though his company produces it. I mean, here you are honoring Bob Shapiro and the others of the New York Academy of Medicine. Will you be doing any kind of coverage of the controversy around biotechnological food on the Today Show?
I'm sure that that'll come up in the future. I mean, I think it's a relatively new field, but I think it's something that obviously a lot of people are concerned about, particularly in Europe. And I think it's such biotechnology is such a new field in general that people haven't really explored that area, but I think they will. And I think certainly that's something that I'm interested in doing more on, and I've even talked to our producers about it in terms of some of the things that are in the food products we're eating, the milk we're drinking. And I think that it's something that's definitely worth exploring.
Do you think, Martin Teitel, that Katie Couric should have been honoring the CEO of Monsanto?
I think that there's a very long list of people who would have been above Bob Shapiro. If you want to honor someone who has done work that is unequivocally in the public interest and for the public good, I sure wish she had picked, to pick a random example, somebody like Ralph Nader. You know, if you create gargantuan structures of power, whether they own life, as in the case of Monsanto and Novartis, or if they own the public airwaves and the dissemination of ideas, in other words, the kind of media that Katie Couric works for, you get the same problems of those huge structures serving their own interests rather than the interests of the public. And so I hope that she does pay attention to the controversy. I have noticed I get called from the relatively established media all the time, Amy, and their questions are getting a little bit better. But basically, including public television and public radio and accepting Pacifica, they look at who pays their bills. And the biotech companies are very, very big donors and are very influential in the media. And so the media cover things like Seattle because they can't avoid it. I don't know if they ever make the connections to the kinds of things you and I are talking about.
Marty Teitel is Executive Director of the Council for Responsible Genetics and co-author of Changing the Nature of Nature. When we come back, a tour of the party at the Waldorf Astoria and more from Martin Teitel. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Out the Waldorf Astoria in New York. I'm Amy Goodman, and we are now going to continue with our conversation with Marty Teitel, Executive Director of the Council for Responsible Genetics based in Cambridge.
I wanted to ask you about the relationship between schools of public health, which certainly should be addressing these issues, and these corporations, because you mentioned that a lot of times these spokespeople would end up being spokespeople for companies like Monsanto, end up coming from schools for public health. So at the event last Wednesday night at the New York Academy of Medicine, I looked up the Columbia School of Public Health table. This was a $500 a plate dinner that was honoring Monsanto and Pfizer. And I just went up to some students and I asked, and teachers, you know, what they thought about all these issues. And I just wanted you to hear a little of their responses and then comment.
What is your name?
Joe Phelan.
Uh-huh. And what do you do at the school?
I teach and do research.
On biotechnology?
Indirectly on the impact of biotechnology on people's attitudes and beliefs and orientations towards people who have illnesses. So kind of like how the new biotechnology impacts on the lives of people who have illnesses.
Well, what do you think about the whole controversy, specifically around Monsanto, because tonight Bob Shapiro is being honored, but the whole issue of public accountability and labeling, knowing what's in the foods that we eat?
I mean, I don't know. To me, the idea of genetically altering food seems like a perfectly fine idea, but it's not something that I, you know, have very informed opinions about.
What do you think of the whole, you know, the public sort of furor over it, even more so in Britain than Europe than here?
It's not really our area, kind of.
Right, but I mean, I think probably anyone on the street would have something to say.
Excuse me, ma'am.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Lorraine LaHutter. I'm the Director of Development here at the Academy.
Yes.
You were invited to come for the cocktail hour and the program, but now I have to ask you to leave.
Why? Why?
Because this is a private invitation event, and now it's time for the medical people of New York City to just enjoy one another's company and to celebrate with the Academy. And I just don't want them to have to be distracted from our event.
Well, I was just asking questions about biotechnology.
Well, I appreciate that, and we gave you an opportunity to do that, but now it's time for us to just...
So should we just wait here to talk to the people as they come out, then?
I'd really rather that you go now. My agreement with the Director of Communications as the Director of Development was that press could be here for the cocktail reception and the program, and that was all.
Right, but we couldn't go into the cocktail reception. We sat on the outside.
Well, press who were tired... did go into the cocktail reception.
Well, we were definitely tired, but then I realized you'd said attired.
What do you mean, press? We're dressed.
Well, no, I mean, I don't know why you didn't go into the cocktail reception. Were you told not to?
Anyway, you get the idea. With that, the director of development pushed us out of the Waldorf Astoria ballroom, and they had a security guard come out to make sure that we didn't go back in. But Martin Teitel, I wanted to ask you about this relationship between the schools of public health and the corporations like Monsanto, and in this case, the New York Academy of Medicine, which supposedly serves the urban poor.
Well, I don't know the relationships specifically in New York, Amy, and so it's I don't want to generalize too much, but I can tell you what my experience has been, which is a tremendous increase in the amount of money that's coming from the biotechnology industry into colleges and universities, and they're focusing heavily on schools of public health, although by no means exclusively on schools of public health. And young people going into these fields are being told, not inaccurately, that there's a lot of money out there for them. This is where the jobs are. So are they going to bite the hand that feeds them? It's so interesting that the person who was working to chuck you out was the director of development. That's the euphemism for the fundraiser. The person who handles their fundraising was the one who didn't want to have, evidently, a free and open discussion of the impacts and significance of biotechnology during her event. Why not? There's been a pattern very, very clearly all along of the biotechnology industry putting huge amounts of money into glossy public relations, something that they've announced that they're going to increase doing, while at the same time stepping real hard on critics. They don't act like an industry that wants a free and open discussion of what it is that they're doing. They want to manage the information, they want to manage the news, they want to manage the critics.
I also thought it was just interesting that here you have someone who's teaching at the School of Public Health, and her just instinct, though she said she wasn't an expert in this field, was to say, no, I don't care about genetically modified food.
Sure, it would be her instinct. And she also said to you a bit before she said that she was interested in public perceptions, something that the biotech industry, it's not unique to them, but something that they do frequently is to try to reduce their critics in the public to a question of perceptions, that the public doesn't really have a good feeling about what we're doing. They don't want to talk about the substance of what they're doing, of what effect this might have on health, on the environment, on corporate control of fundamental resources like food. That's not a conversation they want to have. They want to talk about how people feel about what they're doing or what people perceive about their food. It basically trivializes the democratic process and turns it into a kind of sideshow for the corporatization of biology.
In the introduction book, Ralph Nader quotes Michael Crichton, who warned about the commercialization of molecular biology without federal regulation, without a coherent government policy, and without watchdogs among scientists themselves. He said it's remarkable that nearly every scientist in genetic research is also engaged in the commerce of biotechnology. There are no detached observers.
Well, in science, there are very few. You know, Michael Crichton is the guy who wrote Jurassic Park, which is about genetic engineering run amok. It's a really good allegory for what happens when greed and science hook up and take biotechnology and turn it into, in the case of Jurassic Park, a trivialized corporate product.
This is something else that Robert Shapiro addressed in the interview, and that was the issue of these product defamation lawsuits and the kind of impact they've had on public discourse. Can you explain what they are?
Sure. There are 13 states in the United States that have what are commonly called veggie libel laws. It means that if a person disparages a certain class of agricultural product...
Veggie libel laws?
Veggie libel laws, that you defame vegetables. You diss your broccoli. You say things that causes, I guess the rationale is you say things that cause a group of agricultural people to run the risk of having their livelihood impinged on by your opinions or your views or your facts. And so it gives them standing to be able to sue you. The most famous example is when Oprah Winfrey made some remarks about hamburgers, and she spent $1 million out of her own pocket, which I guess she can afford, to defend herself in Texas against this veggie libel suit. Now, you should understand that these laws are preposterous. I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but the lawyers I've spoken with say, well, you know, sure, it's ridiculous. You can't You can't pass laws that take away people's right to express their opinions about agricultural products. That's not the purpose of the laws. The purpose of the laws is to frighten people, to chill people, literally, from expressing their views, to suppress dissent. It costs, whether you're right or wrong, a tremendous amount of money to defend yourself if you get in trouble with one of these veggie libel suits. When I wrote this book on genetic engineering of food, the publisher spent thousands and thousands of dollars on lawyers while we were doing the manuscript, largely to protect us from these suits. I have to confess to you in all honesty that there have been a number of times when I've spoken in situations publicly where I've found myself up against a certain line and unsure if I should cross that line for fear of putting myself in some kind of legal jeopardy.
Even if what you were saying you knew to be true.
Yeah, well, you know what? The truth is not always what sets you free in the American judicial system. Maybe eventually you win, but unlike Oprah Winfrey, I don't have $1 million to spend on legal bills.
We are talking to Martin Teitel, co-author of Genetically Engineered Food, Changing the Nature of Nature, What You Need to Know to Protect Yourself, Your Family, and Our Planet. Let's talk about, first of all, how genetic engineering works, what it is, so that people can really get a grasp on it.
Well, what the companies say when they're talking to the likes of us, this isn't how they talk when they're charming investors, but when they're talking to us, they say, hey, look, this is just science as usual. This is just ordinary plant breeding that's been going on for millennia. That's not actually the case. Genes, usually one, sometimes two, and as many as three, that come from entirely different living things, different species, different kinds of living things, anything from a pig to a virus, are inserted, sometimes blasted, into the genes of plants. And, you know, plants have, any living thing, has evolved over a very long period of time, mechanisms for defending itself or taking care of genetic combinations that are not functional, that are hazardous, or that don't promote life and health for that living thing. When you do genetically, when you do genetic engineering, what you're doing is going outside the boundaries of those evolutionarily validated protective mechanisms. You're going outside of the mechanisms of evolution, at least to some extent, and that's kind of the core of the concern. I think the second core of the concern is that without any exception that I know of, all of the corporations doing genetically engineered work do that under patents. It's a way of getting ownership over a living thing. If you change the living thing, even in a trivial way, in a way that seems to have no effect, you can then file a patent on it. That will be accepted by the United States Patent and Trademark Office, and then you own it. It's a way of turning living things into corporate products. And I wouldn't minimize the importance of the patent system in biotechnology. Biotechnology works partly by recombining genes and partly by creating regimes of ownership.
You say that the genetic engineering of our food is the most radical transformation in our diet since the invention of agriculture 10,000 years ago.
You bet. You know, for most of human history, for however long you think humans have been around, something like 1 million years, for the vast majority of that time, people got food by going out and finding it. Relatively recently, about 10,000 years ago, people, mostly women, by the way, began shaping those plants very gradually according to the values in those communities, making something a little bigger, a little sweeter, whatever desired outcome that they wanted by normal plant breeding. And the food, until very recently, has reflected the needs and the values of the communities that created the food and grew the food. It's a wonderful partnership because we live because of those domesticated plants, and the domesticated plants live because of us. If either one of us messes up, we both die. It's real a close symbiotic relationship. This is a radical transformation by genetically engineering the crops, because the crops now are wholly owned corporate products. They are not tested adequately for short and long-term safety. They have serious environmental questions that come out of their use. They take communities and farmers out of the equation, and they promote vast monoculture. They also present very, very difficult problems for small farmers outside of the United States. Genetically engineered crops make a certain kind of sense, at least to the folks at companies like Monsanto, make a certain amount of sense in the United States, in a northern country and an industrialized country kind of setting, because they what they really do is enable farmers to cut labor costs. And labor costs are great. They require more water and more chemicals. Those are considered good trade-offs. In southern countries, there are 1.4 billion small farmers in southern countries, Amy. In southern countries, labor is what's cheap. Chemicals and water are what's expensive. And monoculture is what is life-threatening. And genetically engineered crops push southern countries, small farmers, subsistence farmers in countries like India, much of Africa, much of China, towards dangerous monoculture and towards having to use huge amounts of water and chemical inputs.
Marty Teitel, what are the risks of eating what you call gen food?
Well, probably the biggest risk is that you're putting money into the pocket of a corporation that then is taking over the world's food supply, quite literally. It sounds a little paranoid, but it's true. They are taking over the world's food supply. It is handing over the substance that sustains humanity to the board of directors of a company like Monsanto. The immediate hazards to an individual have to do with several different levels of concern. One is allergies to introduced genes, both to genes that have been introduced and to novel protein combinations that are created. I don't want to get into science, and there's probably someone else who can teach science better than I can, but let me just say, Amy, that all genes code for proteins. Genes make proteins. That's all they do. Each gene just creates a protein. When you insert novel genes, genes from fish into plants, for example, you're then creating protein combinations that your body has never experienced before. And allergists I've spoken with are actually more concerned about novel protein combinations than they are about specific allergies to specific inserted genes.
We have to break away, but you'll be hearing more from Martin Teitel in the days to come. He's co-author of the book Changing the Nature of Nature, What You Need to Know to Protect Yourself and Your Family and Our Planet. He's also executive director of the Council for Responsible Genetics in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Its phone number is 617-868-0870. That's 617-868-0870. And the organization's website is www.gene-watch.org. That's www.gene-watch.org. And by the way, if you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call our archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!